Places like Harlem and Chicago are often associated with the Great Black Renaissance. But for a brief period of time in the 20th century, Pittsburgh was the epicenter of black arts, sports, business, and political influence. 90.5 WESA's Virginia Alvino Young spoke with author Mark Whitaker about his new book, The Untold Story of Smoketown, The Other Great Black Renaissance, which traces the origins and decline of Pittsburgh's vibrant black community from the 1920s through the 1950s.
Mark Whitaker, thanks so much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So what was this special confluence of circumstances that was able to breed all of this cultural wealth here in Pittsburgh?
There were three things that were sort of, I think, different about the black community than the communities in other cities, like Harlem, which is associated with the Great Black Renaissance, or Chicago, right, which people also talk about in terms of having a renaissance. One was where the migrants came from. They came particularly in the early waves of the migration heavily from the northern and eastern parts of the Old South. So from states like Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, North Carolina. And so if they had been slaves or their parents or grandparents had been slaves, they were just as likely to have been house slaves than field slaves. And some of them came from freed families going back several generations. So a lot of them arrived in Pittsburgh knowing how to read, playing instruments, reading music. So they arrived with a great deal of sophistication. If you were coming all the way from the South, it took a lot of initiative to get all the way to Pittsburgh. And so I think there was also kind of a self-selection process that in some ways it was perhaps people who were particularly motivated and particularly ambitious who ended up here. Then there were educational opportunities available in Pittsburgh that were quite rare for black folks in that era. What's now Pitt started admitting black students under a scholarship funded by a white abolitionist named Charles Avery right after the Civil War. And the high schools in Pittsburgh at the turn of the century were better funded than any public high schools in the country, thanks to all the Gilded Age money that was around at that time. And then I think the third factor was that Pittsburgh was really a city built around business. And in the 19th century, white immigrants, some of them quite poor, arrived here and created the steel industry, created the foodstuffs industry with Heinz, made Pittsburgh a center for banking, you know, with the Mellon Empire. And those industries attracted black folks from the South. And often, you know, when they arrived here, it turned out that it was hard to get jobs in the steel mills and so forth. However, a lot of them then started businesses of their own.
The Pittsburgh Courier, which is still around today. Mm-hmm. During that era, what was the publication's impact on not just black politics, but American politics overall?
Well, you know, it was really extraordinary. And the Courier has not gotten enough historical attention, in my opinion, in terms of just sheer numbers that was sold, but also in influence. And it ranged from sports, for example. I mean, I have a whole chapter about the role that the Courier played in the rise of Joe Louis, the role that the Courier and a sports writer named Wendell Smith played in the Jackie Robinson story. I mean, Wendell Smith crusaded for the integration of Major League Baseball for a decade. But I think what people don't appreciate is that in addition to all that sort of cultural influence, the Courier also had a tremendous amount of political influence. So Robert L. Vann, until the early 30s, black voters in America overwhelmingly voted Republican, essentially out of loyalty to the memory of Abraham Lincoln, the great emancipator. But by the early 30s, Robert L. Vann, who himself was a loyal Republican, had just decided that the Republican Party was not doing enough for black folks. They were taking them for granted. Does that sound familiar in terms of the debates we're still having? So he gave a speech, reprinted it in the Courier and distributed it around the country, in which he said that it was time for black voters to turn Lincoln's picture to the wall and vote for the Democrats. There was a sort of political migration that changed American politics in the 1930s. It all started with Robert L. Vann, the Courier, here in the Pittsburgh area. Then Vann went on to crusade relentlessly for opportunity for black soldiers. So as World War II started to loom, Vann was lobbying Roosevelt, in Washington basically demanding, whether it was even keeping black units segregated or integrating the army, either way, blacks had to be given more opportunity. And the Courier, his name and the Courier's name was on a lot of legislation that was proposed in those days. As a result, when America did enter the war after Pearl Harbor, there were more opportunities. The Courier continued to crusade on behalf of black soldiers and sent more war correspondents to cover black soldiers at the front than any other newspaper in America.
In your book, you take stock of this amazing period, but you trace it back then nearly a century before to some of the city's first Negro settlers before the Civil War.
Right.
So tell me about a figure like Cap Posey and the lasting impact of him and men like him.
So Cap Posey, Cumberland Posey Sr., was born a slave after the war. His father, who became a minister, moved the family to Ohio, and he got a job on a riverboat. His job was to clean the decks. Mm-hmm. But he looked around and he said, well, the guys who actually run this boat, the engineers, what do they do? So he started studying them. He convinced a white steamboat owner to give him a shot at being an assistant engineer. But he did a good enough job at that he was then got a job as a chief engineer. And so he was the first black African-American chief engineer. He then was hired to run a whole fleet of steamboats for a white owner. And he decided to relocate to the Pittsburgh area, to Homestead. From his base in Homestead, he basically built a business, first as a shipbuilder, and then he invested in a coal mine. And by the turn of the century, he was the wealthiest black man in Pittsburgh. And I have a picture in the book of like this huge mansion he had in Homestead. You look at it and it's like you can't imagine that, you know, a black man could live in a home like that. He did business with Carnegie and with Frick. Cap Posey goes on to not only was a fascinating character in his own right, but to become a huge part of the legacy of 20th century Pittsburgh. One, he was the first big investor in the Courier. And he had three children, his youngest child, who was his namesake. Cap Posey Jr. ended up running and then owning the Homestead Grays and becoming a giant in the Negro Leagues.
How did it all disappear? Like lots of other northern cities, Pittsburgh faced industry decline, the white population fleeing to the suburbs, you know, urban renewal. But lastly, I've heard you talk about black brain drain at the time. What happened there?
Well, as you say, it was a sad story. And, you know, I talk about there was sort of a perfect storm or a perfect confluence of these three factors that hit the black community here in Pittsburgh all at once, starting in the late 50s and through the 60s. One was a decline of the steel industry, as you said, which hit the whole city very hard. But the difference with the black population is that that was precisely the era where a lot of white folks were already leaving the city to move to the suburbs. It was easy for them to get loans and so forth, much more difficult for black folks. The second was urban renewal efforts, which were, you know, well-meaning. But as part of that, they decided that they wanted to build a big civic arena. When they decided where they should locate it, they picked the Lower Hill. It was also convenient because they could get a lot of slum clearance money from the federal government to fund it all. And so starting in the late 50s, they tore down the entire Lower Hill. Now, it is true that there was housing with essentially kind of, you know, substandard slum-like conditions there. But also in the Lower Hill were the nightclubs, the churches, the social clubs, the barbershops. It was the center of black business. So first of all, it eliminated, you know, the center of black life in the city. It cut off the hill from downtown with, you know, disastrous results. And it forced the displacement of 80,000 residents of the Lower Hill. So most of them had to move into surrounding neighborhoods. Those had previously been mixed neighborhoods. Some black folks lived there, but it was very, you know, racially and ethnically mixed. But once the black population sort of reached a certain level there, all the remaining white folks left. And those neighborhoods and their schools and so forth went in decline. The city didn't support them anymore. There wasn't the tax base. But the third factor that you mention is black middle class brain drain. People like my father, his parents were fairly prosperous business people. They ran a funeral home. He grew up in Homewood. He went to Westinghouse High School. In a previous era, he would have stayed. He would have become a business leader or a journalist or, you know, maybe a political leader. Instead, he goes away to Swarthmore College outside of Philadelphia, becomes a professor. He never comes back. And there were a whole generation like that, neighborhoods like The Hill, but also other urban neighborhoods across America were left without the kind of leadership they would have otherwise had at precisely the moment they really needed it.
What is going to be the role of African Americans now in Pittsburgh's newest renaissance, which is rooted in technology, but as many folks are noticing, already really an industry struggling with diversity?
It's an unfinished story. It remains to be seen. Here's what I think. You go to some of these neighborhoods, and it's really, you don't kind of know where to begin in terms of how do you bring them back and gentrification and so forth. It's going to take, I think, not only an investment by the city and maybe federal dollars if you can get them, although, you know, in the current administration, I wouldn't count on it. But also, I would hope that these new industries that are moving into Pittsburgh and expanding would look around and saying, maybe we have a stake in trying to help these neighborhoods. And I think particularly the schools. You know, I spent a day at Westinghouse High School, but I just wanted to see what had become of this great school where Billy Strayhorn went and Mary Lou Williams and Ahmad Jamal and my father graduated. I kept thinking, you know, these tech companies, you know, Google, Facebook, Uber, they should really be doing something with these schools. But I think that if Pittsburgh just generally wants to continue to sort of fulfill its promise in terms of what it could be and what it could be brought back to, it can't have these neighborhoods like sticking out like sore thumbs right in the middle. You know, on the one hand, it was remarkable that this small community, you know, accomplished everything that it did in the era I write about. On the other hand, there was never critical mass in terms of numbers to really influence city government. So one big difference between Pittsburgh and, say, Chicago or even Philadelphia or Newark, where there was a strong enough black political base that eventually you had black mayors, you had black city councilmen, you had, you know, that didn't happen to the same degree in Pittsburgh. But, you know, at the very least, I will say this, that if you grow up in Pittsburgh and you're a good student and you can go to a good college, there's actually a reason to stay in Pittsburgh now or to come back, which there wasn't. So I don't know how many, you know, the kind of numbers you're talking about there, but that in and of itself, I think, is a change.
The book is The Untold Story of Smoketown, The Other Great Black Renaissance. Mark Whitaker, thanks so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.